This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. The income gap between rich and poor, the divide between religious and secular, the declining public trust in government. For political scientist Patrick Deneen, these are just some of the glaring signs that liberalism has failed. Not left-wing liberalism, but the larger political philosophy that forms the foundation for modern democracy. Deneen's new book is aptly called Why Liberalism Failed, and he tracks where this ideology came from and how it evolved over time. Barack Obama says the book was on a summer reading list. We haven't checked with him to see how he did, but we assume that he read it, and it's making an impact both in liberal and conservative circles, not making everybody happy, which suggests it is a good book. Patrick Deneen is a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. He's in town for a talk at Duke University's Kenan Institute for Ethics, and he joins me in the studio now. Patrick Deneen, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Why? Why has it failed? How do you what do you mean when you say has liberalism failed? What are you even talking about?
So the book is a kind of exists on a makes an argument about a kind of paradox, and it's interesting. I was listening to your last segment about the French Revolution. The author that maybe inspired me the most was another Frenchman, Alexis de Tocqueville, who wrote Democracy in America, who made the observation that I'm really just kind of stealing, that every regime has a kind of built-in expiration date. And more often than not, the expiration date is not when the regime, the political order, ceases to be true to itself, but when it becomes most fully and completely true to itself, when it embodies its core principles. And that this is especially true when we're talking about an ideology, when we're talking about a vision or an understanding of human beings that in certain senses doesn't actually conform to the messiness of human nature. And so my argument is basically that liberalism is an ideology. It has an emanation in the French Revolution. It certainly has its form in the American order and more broadly in the liberal West today. And its ideology is really the liberation of the individual from kind of arbitrary, what are seen as arbitrary relationships, bonds, restraints, restrictions, associations, and so forth. And that the more successful we are in that effort, the more it results in a kind of evaporation of civic and political bonds.
Well, let's talk about how that happens, because it seems to me that part of the reason for that is that it becomes a victim of its own success because it really can't understand where it's going as an ideology, right? I mean, people are being very thoughtful about creating ideas about human freedom, human rights. These are not ideas that exist in the 10th century. We don't have rights. There's a divine right of kings. There's God, the king, and then there's y'all. And that's just how that thing goes. So the notion that we would somehow, each of us, the king and the turnip grower, have equal rights is a new idea 500 years ago. Where does this come from?
Well, I mean, the idea of rights, of course, is actually quite ancient. It's not new with liberalism. But in some ways, what is new is the idea of rights that are detached from any kind of human relationship or a kind of a pre-existing human community. So the trope you get in the beginnings of the liberal philosophical project is the idea of a state of nature that strips human beings down to this kind of almost to their barest form and says, what do we know about human beings? And basically what we know about human beings is that they have rights and that they have no real formative or substantial relationships with any other human being, that they're autonomous, free selves. So what you really get is a detachment from rights, from a conception of duty that you hold. And so rights become free-floating, detached from any kind of deep responsibility and relationship with other human beings. And the political order itself becomes dedicated to advancing rights, and I'm not going to argue with that. But it doesn't, let's say, emphasize with nearly the same volume and emphasis the essential nature of our shared duties together.
Well, or it does, and you even talk about this in your book, but the insurance that those duties and responsibilities are going to be performed and understood lies in the institutions that those ideologues had understood quite well, church, family. You'll learn. So the idea is, if I pursue my own interests, the world's going to be a fine place. And what keeps me from being a tyrant is the fact that the church has told me how to act in a way, and my family and my mom taught me how to act. And because those institutions are strong, please correct me if I'm mischaracterizing this, I can count on that individual pursuing their rights, not turning us into hash.
Yeah, and what's fascinating is that the ideologies, I mean, think about the French Revolution, one of the first things it seeks to do is to eliminate those kinds of institutions entirely, anything that's seen as a kind of competitor of the state. And you see the same thing happen under communism. You see the same thing happen under fascism, those great ideologies. And, of course, one of the things that we've always treasured about liberalism is that liberalism leaves these institutions free, allows them to flourish, that it relies on these institutions to provide for cultivating the sense of duty and civic a kind of civic obligation. And yet we also see that liberalism perhaps much more insidiously acts as a solvent on our participation in these kinds of, let's say, associations and voluntary kinds of groups. And if you look across the kind of board in a lot of findings in social science, what you find is that in associational life, certainly in religion, in family formation today, the likelihood of marrying, the likelihood of having children, the likelihood of marriages lasting, and we could keep going, that what we see is a kind of logic of the regime where the individual becomes liberated from any of these kinds of formative institutions. And I think there's a kind of logic to this that ends up undermining the necessary culture that liberalism requires but ultimately can't itself sustain.
Does this mean that the notion of democracy itself was really ill-formed from its birth, that we've been on the wrong path all along?
To revert again to Alexis de Tocqueville, Tocqueville really saw all this when he was writing about America in the 1830s and 1840s. What he saw was that democracy would have this powerful tendency both toward individualism and to replacing these kinds of relationships with depersonalized mechanisms. And the two depersonalized mechanisms that he saw in particular was the state, the centralized state, and the market. A market that we're familiar with as a globalized market. And that these two depersonalized mechanisms of our relationships would sort of absorb all of this kind of what had been the sinews of democracy. And what Tocqueville advises us in, roughly 100 years ago, is don't let that happen. Retain as much as you can the kinds of bonds and relationships that combat both a kind of individualism on the one hand and a depersonalization of our lives on the others. And if you think about where we are today, our political battles tend to be over which form of depersonalization do we prefer. Yeah. And if you're on the right, it's the market. And if you're on the left, it's the state. But it's also that, in many ways, what our political battles end up being is both advancing the kind of sense of powerlessness of individuals. If you think about where the great political response or reaction or some of our crisis in politics today, it's simultaneously the belief that we as individuals no longer control the state and we as individuals no longer control the economy, that right. These are all forces that control us. So the very sources of our liberation now become, in many ways, a kind of form of perceived bondage.
And if there is liberation, then this, I think, to some degree explains the power of fascist rhetoric throughout the 20th century, and now we see it writ large in the 21st century. First, reinforce the sense of powerlessness and then promote the great leader as the one into whose ego you can flow and who will liberate you from your sense of bondage.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think that the what we're seeing today is a very powerful political response, both in the United States and, of course, in Europe, that arises from the sense of powerlessness. And on the one hand, it's I think from the standpoint of those, and I would include myself, who have lived our lives in fairly elite institutions and are doing well, generally speaking, in the world of globalization. Our first response is to say, well, this is simply a fascist response. I think as members of a democracy, we need to at least have the capacity of listening to the sources of this. And I'm not talking about sympathizing with Donald Trump. That's awfully hard for anyone to do. But not dismissing out of hand the deeper causes that gave rise, not only to him, but what we're seeing across Europe, which is this deep sense of powerlessness. And also the experience of no longer controlling one's fate that is so widely the experience of people outside of our circles.
But don't you need some kind of, first of all, some ideology of collectivism to begin to rebuild that? In other words, if social bond is the glue, if that's where the love is on which we can rebuild, then we have to believe that we're not in it for ourselves and by ourselves. So we have to believe in some form of communalism, and that has to be expressed institutionally in something we build together, right?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And that's actually where I end my book. A lot of people have been critical of me for not proposing a replacement ideology for liberalism. And I sort of think that's one of our problems, is that we shouldn't try to replace an ideology with another ideology. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in odd ways, I think right now our politics is sort of – we're on a teeter-totter between either defending liberalism or moving in the direction of a kind of newly revived socialism or a newly revived fascism. And it seems to me I'll have none of the above. And my answer, perhaps while unsatisfying, is precisely the direction you suggest, which is if we don't want any of these futures that are potentially quite inhumane – you know, that may involve the guillotine in some form,
right.
Then we should be really repairing our associational life and our communal life. But more than that, and this is a message that I've been bringing around to a lot of college campuses I've been invited to, we should make the breakdown of these kinds of relationships and bonds and institutions, especially among our least fortunate fellow citizens, a primary task and duty of how we think of our role, particularly as people who are given great advantages in our society. I've been teaching at wonderful universities my entire adult life, Princeton, Georgetown, and the University of Notre Dame, and I see almost entirely silence when it comes to especially the breakdown of family life, institutional life, including churches, and what once was, it seems to me, the formative institutions that make it possible to have a flourishing life regardless of your income.
But when we begin to notice those things, it is not as though no one is speaking up for those. There is a loud voice in favor of, and remember, liberal democracy also begins with the notion of limited government. But if government has a role, it is precisely to protect the rights of those who perhaps are least likely to defend themselves. And so the rights of minorities, though an afterthought in the American Constitution, does get there pretty quickly. And that's what the government is empowered to do. We seem to have lost that, and when we suggest it, when you hear from those quarters, this group of people has been disadvantaged by the system, look at them and fix it, we're hurt till that you hear claims of socialism and more creeping government, and the government is too big now, and government is the problem. A famous president, Ronald Reagan, you know, won office by telling us the government was the problem. How do you build that and not open yourself to that charge?
I think one of the things that we've seen in our politics today is a lot of people are fed up with the political divide that has developed in our country today. And there's not yet any coherent alternative to this. But I think there would be a lot of shared space for people who were, on the one hand, shared the view that a lot of our problems arises from a government that now is too distant, and that can't solve the kinds of problems that we see in many of our communities, that even goodwill and a lot of money don't solve problems like the war on poverty, which reduced poverty by 1% over 40 or 50 years. But on the other hand, are also quite frustrated by the sense of powerlessness in the modern economic order, and that they feel more or less that if you're born with advantages, you'll do well in our economic order, and if you're not born with those advantages, you're on your own. It's sort of sink or swim. And that, interestingly, the reaction against the political center in the last election, you had many people on the left supporting Bernie, many people on the right supporting Donald Trump, was in its own way the beginnings or inkling of a possible kind of alignment in American politics where a common concern could be born, that what's needed is a lot more sense that we need to support each other's common effort to achieve the capacity to govern ourselves. And that's both economic and political.
But I would say, don't you think, I mean, this is going to require some kind of intervention, some sort of legislation. And we've had these attempts at legislation to protect minorities against what is clearly a criminal justice, a penal system that works to the disadvantaged. Need to pass laws through government. And the resistance to that is enormous, even though the evidence that for the need is equally compelling. So it has to begin there. You can't talk about creating a whole new system for governance and then saying, hey, have you noticed how many black people are being shot in the street? It has to be done through the system. And the voices, it seems to me, are squelched by this notion that government is the problem.
Yeah. I don't disagree with any of that. But at the same time that there's an emphasis upon that, of course, you know, I live in South Bend, Indiana. We have, you know, we have a lot of issues with that any Rust Belt city has. Mm-hmm. And a piece of legislation that might be passed in Washington, D.C. is not going to solve the problem of how policing is done in our streets. I mean, it can do some things, you know, I think at the margins. But what we really need are community measures that ensure that there's fair and decent treatment of every citizen of our city, regardless of who you are, where you come from, what neighborhood you live in. And there needs to be a lot more effort to bring together various of our neighborhoods. And unless that's addressed at a very local level, a national solution, I think, is not superfluous to that.
We're even seeing states, including North Carolina, that are limiting the rights of localities to pass that kind of legislation.
Yeah.
They're stepping in from Raleigh telling cities, you can't preserve the rights of your citizens because we're telling you, as this legislature, we're taking that right away from you.
Yeah, I'll put my cards on the table. I'm a Catholic, and I believe very much in the Catholic doctrine of subsidiarity, which is that problems that can be solved as close to home as possible should be solved there. And where they can't be solved there, then you move it up to the next level of government. And the problem is we've had a generation of Republicans and conservatives talk about localism and decentralization, but when it comes to their sacred cows, you lose any sense that that's actually a legitimate principle. There needs to be a principled application of the view that if something can be better solved at a local level, this not only, I think, leads to much more sort of investment by people who are most directly affected, but it exercises our democratic muscles and it exercises our civic muscles. And what one of the things Tocqueville talks about is that citizenship is a verb. It's not a noun. Mm-hmm. And unless we're actually acting as citizens, then we will lose what it is to be a citizen.
Great stuff. Patrick Dineen, professor of political science at University of Notre Dame, in town for a talk at Duke's Kenan Institute for Ethics. His book is called Why Liberalism Failed, and you can find links to our website, stateofthings.org. Patrick Dineen, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things, a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.